This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Our Dark Duet, a Monsters of Verity novel by Victoria Schwab, performed by Therese Plummer. He who fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. If you gaze long into an abyss, the abyss also gazes into you. Friedrich Nietzsche. Hell is empty. All the devils are here. William Shakespeare, The Tempest. Prelude. Out in the waste stood a home, abandoned. A place where a girl had grown up and a boy had burned alive. Where a violin had been shattered and a stranger had been shot. And a new monster had been born. She stood in the house, the dead man at her feet, stepped over his body, wandered out into the yard, drew in fresh air as the sun went down, and started walking. Out in the waste stood a warehouse, forgotten. A place where the air was still full of blood and hunger and heat. Where the girl had escaped and the boy had fallen and the monsters were defeated. All except for one. He lay on the warehouse floor, a steel bar driven through his back. It scraped his heart with every beat. And black blood spread like a shadow beneath his dark suit. The monster was dying, but not dead. She found him lying there and pulled the weapon from his back, watching as he spit black blood onto the warehouse floor and rose to meet her. He knew that his maker was dead, and she knew that hers was not. Not yet. Verse 1. Monster Hunter. Chapter 1. Prosperity. Kate Harker hit the ground running. Blood dripped from a shallow cut on her calf, and her lungs were sore from the blow she'd taken to the chest. Thank God for armor, even if it was makeshift.
Turn right.
Her boots slid on the slick pavement as she rounded the corner onto a side street. She swore when she saw it was full of people, restaurant canopies up and tables out despite the brewing storm. Teo's voice rose in her ear.
It's catching up!
Kate backtracked and took off down the main road.
If you don't want a mass casualty event, find me somewhere else.
Half a block, then cut right, said B, and Kate felt like the avatar in some multiplayer game where a girl was chased by monsters through a massive city. Only this massive city was real. The capital at the heart of prosperity. And so were the monsters. Well, monster. She'd taken out one, but a second was heading her way. The shadows wicked around her as she ran. A chill twisted through the damp night and fat drops of rain dripped under her collar and down her back.
Left up ahead, instructed B. And Kate bolted past a row of shops and down an alley, leaving a trail of fear and blood like breadcrumbs in her wake. She reached a narrow lot and a wall, only it wasn't a wall, but a warehouse door, and for a split second she was back in the abandoned building in the waste, cuffed to a bar in a blacked-out room, while somewhere beyond the door, metal struck bone, and someone left. Kate blinked the memory away as Bea repeated her instruction, but she was sick of running. And the door was ajar, so she went straight, out of the rain and into the vacant space. There were no windows in the warehouse, no light at all save that from the street behind her, which reached only a few feet. The rest of the steel structure was plunged into solid black. Kate's pulse pounded in her head as she cracked a glorified glow stick, Liam's idea, and tossed it into the shadows, flooding the warehouse with steady white light.
Kate, chimed in Riley for the first time. Be careful.
She snorted. Count on Riley to give useless advice. She scanned the warehouse, spotted crates piled within reach of the steel rafters overhead, and started to climb, hauling herself the last of the way up just as the door rattled on its hinges. Kate froze. She held her breath as fingers, not flesh and bone, but something else, curled around the door and slid it open. Static sounded in her good ear.
Status? Asked Liam nervously.
Busy, she hissed, balancing on the rafters as the monster filled the doorway. And for an instant, Kate imagined Sloane's red eyes, his shining fangs, his dark suit.
Come out, little Catherine, he'd say. Let's play a game.
The sweat on her skin chilled, but it was just her mind playing tricks on her. The creature edging forward into the warehouse wasn't a Malkai. It was something else entirely. It had a Malkai's red eyes, yes, and a Corsai's sharp claws, but its skin was the bluish black of a rotting corpse, and it wasn't after flesh or blood. It fed on hearts. Kate didn't know why she'd assumed the monsters would be the same. Verity had its triad, but here she had only come across a single kind, so far. Then again, Verity boasted the highest crime rate of all 10 territories, thanks in large part, she was sure, to her father, while Prosperity's sins were harder to place. On the books, Prosperity was the wealthiest territory by half, but it was a robust economy rotting from the inside out. If Verity's sins were knives, quick and vicious, then Prosperity's were poison. Slow, insidious, but just as deadly. And when the violence began to coalesce into something tangible, something monstrous, it didn't happen all at once, as in Verity, but in a drip, slow enough that most of the city was still pretending the monsters weren't real. The thing in the warehouse suggested otherwise. The monster inhaled, as though trying to smell her, a chilling reminder of which of them was the predator and which, for the moment, was prey. Fear scraped along her spine as its head swung from side to side, and then it looked up at her. Kate didn't wait. She dropped down, catching herself on the steel rafter to ease the fall. She landed in a crouch between the monster and the warehouse door, spikes flashing in her hands, each the length of her forearm and filed to a vicious point. Looking for me? The creature turned, flashing 2 dozen blue-black teeth in a feral grimace.
Kate, pressed Teo. You see it?
Yeah, she said dryly.
I see it.
Bea and Liam both started talking, but Kate tapped her ear and the voices dropped out, replaced a second later by a strong beat, a heavy bass. The music filled her head, drowning out her fear and her doubt and her pulse and every other useless thing. The monster curled its long fingers, and Kate braced herself. The first one had tried to punch right through her chest. She'd have the bruises to prove it. But the attack didn't come.
What's the matter?
She chided, her voice lost beneath the beat.
Is my heart not good enough?
She had wondered, briefly, in the beginning, if the crimes written on her soul would somehow make her less appetizing. Apparently not. A second later, the monster lunged. Kate was always surprised to discover that monsters were fast, no matter how big, no matter how ugly. She dodged back, quick on her feet. 5 years and 6 private schools worth of self-defense had given her a head start, but the last 6 months hunting down things that went bump in Prosperity, that had been the real education. She danced between blows, trying to avoid the monster's claws and get under its guard. Nails raked the air above Kate's head as she ducked and slashed the iron spike across the creature's outstretched hand. It snarled and swung at her,
recoiling only after its claws bit into her sleeve and hit copper mesh beneath. The armor absorbed most of the damage, but Kate still hissed as somewhere on her arm the skin parted and blood welled up. She let out a curse and drove her boot into the creature's chest. It was twice her size, made of hunger and gore and God knew what else. But the sole of her shoe was plated with iron, and the creature went staggering backward, clawing at itself as the pure metal burned away a stretch of mottled flesh, exposing the thick membrane that shielded its heart. Bullseye. Kate launched herself forward, aiming for the still sizzling mark. The spike punched through cartilage and muscle before sinking easily into that vital core. Funny, she thought, that even monsters had fragile hearts. Her momentum carried her forward, and the monster fell back, and they went down together, its body collapsing beneath her into a mound of gore and rot. Kate staggered to her feet, holding her breath against the noxious fumes until she reached the warehouse door. She slumped against it, pressing a palm to the gash on her arm. The song was ending in her ear, and she switched the feed back to control.
How long has it been?
We have to do something.
Shut up, she said. I'm here. A string of profanity, a few stock lines of relief.
Status? Asked B.
Kate pulled the cell from her pocket, snapped a photo of the gory slick on the concrete, and hit send.
Jesus, answered B.
Wicked, said Liam. Looks fake, offered Teo.
Riley sounded queasy.
Do they always fall apart?
The litany in her ear was just another reminder that these people had no business being on this end of the fight. They had their purpose, but they weren't like her. Weren't hunters.
How about you, Kate? Asked Riley. You okay?
Blood soaked her calf and dripped from her fingers, and truth be told, she felt a little dizzy. But Riley was human. She didn't have to tell him the truth. Peachy, she said, killing the call before any of them could hear the catch in her breath. The glow stick flickered and faded, plunging her back into the dark. But she didn't mind. It was empty now. Chapter 2 Kate climbed the stairs, leaving drops of gray water in her wake. The rain had started up again halfway back to the apartment, and she'd relished the soaking despite the cold, letting it wash away the worst of the black blood and gore. Even so, she still looked like she'd gotten in a fight with a jar of ink, and lost. She reached the third floor landing and let herself in.
Honey, I'm home.
No answer, of course. She was crashing in Riley's apartment, an apartment his parents paid for, while he was off living in sin with his boyfriend Malcolm. She remembered seeing the place for the first time, the exposed brick, the art, the overstuffed furniture designed for comfort, and thinking Riley's parents clearly shopped in a different catalog than Callum Harker. She'd never lived alone before. The school dorms had always been two to a room, and back at Harker Hall, she'd had her father, at least in theory, and his shadow, Sloane. She'd always assumed she'd relish the eventual privacy, the freedom, but it turned out that being alone lost some of its charm when you didn't have a choice. She smothered the wave of self-pity before it could crest and headed for the bathroom, peeling off her armor as she went. Armor was a pretty fancy word for the copper mesh stretched over paintball gear, but Liam's combined interests in costume design and war games did the job, 90% of the time. The other 10, well, it was just sharp claws and bad luck. She caught a reflection in the bathroom mirror. Damp blonde hair slicked back, black gore freckling pale cheeks, and met her own gaze.
Where are you?
She murmured, wondering how other Kates and other lives were spending their night. She'd always liked the idea that there was a different you for every choice you made, and every choice you didn't. And somewhere out there were Kates who had never returned to Verity, and never begged to leave. Ones who could still hear out of both ears, and had two parents instead of none,
ones who hadn't run, hadn't killed, hadn't lost everything. Where are you? Once upon a time, the first image in her head would have been the house beyond the waste, with its high grass and its wide-open sky. Now it was the woods behind Colton, an apple in her hand and birdsong overhead, and a boy who wasn't a boy with his back against a tree. She turned the shower on, wincing as she peeled away the last of the fabric. Steam bloomed across the glass, and she bit back a groan as hot water struck raw skin. She leaned against the tiles and thought of another city, another house, another shower. A monster slumped in the bath, a boy burning from the inside out, her hand wrapped around his. I'm not going to let you fall. As the scalding water ran gray and rust red and then finally clear, she considered her skin. She was becoming a patchwork of scars. From the teardrop in the corner of her eye and the pale line that ran from temple to jaw, marks of the car crash that had killed her mother, to the curve of a Maokai's teeth along her shoulder and the silvery gash of a Corsai's claws across her ribs. And then there was the mark she couldn't see, the one she'd made herself when she raised her father's gun and pulled the trigger and killed a stranger, staining her soul red. Kate snapped the water off. As she taped up her latest cuts, she wondered if, somewhere, there was a version of herself having fun. Feet up on the back of a theater seat while movie monsters slunk out of the shadows and people in the audience screamed because it was fun to be afraid when you knew you were safe. It shouldn't make her feel better, imagining those other lives, but it did. One of those paths led to happiness, even while Kate's own had led her here. But here, she told herself, was exactly where she was supposed to be. She'd spent 5 years trying to become the daughter her father wanted. Strong, hard, monstrous. Only to learn that her father didn't want her at all. But he was dead, and Kate wasn't. And she'd had to find something to do. Someone to be. Some way to put all those skills to use. And she knew it wasn't enough. No matter how many monsters she slayed, it wouldn't undo the one she'd made. Wouldn't erase the red from her soul. But life only moved forward. And here in prosperity, Kate had found a purpose, a point. And now when she met her gaze in the mirror, she didn't see a girl who was sad or lonely or lost. She saw a girl who wasn't afraid of the dark. She saw a girl who hunted monsters. And she was damn good at it. Chapter 3. Hunger gnawed at Kate's bones, but she was too tired to go in search of food. She turned the radio up and slumped onto the couch, sighing at the simple comfort of clean hair and a soft sweatshirt. She'd never been all that sentimental, but living out of a duffel bag taught you to value the things you had. The sweatshirt was from Layton, the third of her 6 boarding schools. She had no fondness for the school itself, but the sweatshirt was worn and warm, a little piece of a past life. She didn't let herself cling to these pieces, holding on just tight enough that they wouldn't slip away. Besides, the latent colors were forest green and cool gray, way better than St. Agnes's horror show of red and purple and brown. She booted up her tablet and logged into the private chat space Bea had carved out in the infinite world of Prosperity's open drive. "Welcome to the Wardens," said the screen. That was the name they'd chosen for themselves, Liam and Bea and Teo, before Kate ever showed up. Riley hadn't been a part of it either, not until she brought him in. "Liam and me."
"Ha ha 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 ha, wolves."
Teo, much to handle.
"It's a cover-up. Everyone knows what happened in Verity."
Biatch.
"See no evil? Hear no evil. Tell yourself there's no evil."
Liam and me.
Dunno. I had a mean-ass cat once.
For a moment, Kate just stared at the screen and asked herself for the 100th time what she was doing here. Talking to these people. Letting them in. She hated that part of her craved this simple contact, even looked forward to it.
Riled up. Did you guys catch that headline about the explosion on Broad?
Kate hadn't gone looking for friends. She'd never played well with others. Never stayed in a school long enough to make any real connections.
Riled up. Guy walked into his apartment, pulled the gas line straight out of the wall.
Sure, Kate understood the value of friends, the social currency of being part of a group, but she'd never gotten the emotional appeal. Friends wanted you to be honest. Friends wanted you to share. Friends wanted you to listen and care and worry and do a dozen other things Kate had no time for. All she'd wanted was a lead.
Riled up. Roommate was home when it happened.
Kate had landed in Prosperity 6 months ago with that one duffel, $500 in cash, and a bad feeling that got worse with every piece of news. Dog attacks, gang violence, suspicious activity, brutal acts, suspects at large, crime scenes disturbed, weapons missing.
Liam and me. Creepy.
Biatch. Downer, Riley. A dozen stories all sporting the telltale signs, the kind made by teeth and claws. And then there were the whispers on the open drive, referencing the same place. The names scraping over skin. Verity. But short of putting an "Eat Me" sign on her back and wandering the streets at night, Kate wasn't exactly sure where to start. Finding monsters had never been a problem in Verity. But here, for every actual sighting, there were 100 trolls and conspiracy theorists co-opting the threads. It was a needle in a haystack where a bunch of idiots were shouting, "Something poked me!" But there, threaded through the static, she noticed them. The same voices showing up over and over, trying to be heard. They called themselves the Wardens, and they weren't hunters, but hackers. Hacktivists, according to Liam. Convinced that the authorities were either incompetent or determined to bury the news. The Wardens scoured sites and dug through footage, flagging anything that looked suspicious. Then leaked the data to the press and plastered it on the threads, trying to get someone to listen. And Kate had. She'd taken one of their leads and run with it. And when it had panned out, she'd gone to the source for more. And that's when she'd learned that the Wardens were just a couple of college students and a 14-year-old who never slept. Teo, much to handle.
Yeah, that's sad, but what does it have to do with heart eaters?
Biatch. Since when are we calling them heart eaters?
Liam and me. Since they started eating hearts, duh.
She still didn't want friends. But despite her best efforts, she was getting to know them. B, who was addicted to dark chocolate and wanted to be a research scientist. Teo, who never sat still, even at a treadmill desk in his dorm. Liam, who lived with his grandparents and cared too much for his own good. Riley, whose family would kill him if they knew where he spent his nights. And what did they know about her? Nothing but a name, and even that was only half true. To the Wardens, she was Kate Gallagher, a runaway with a knack for hunting monsters. She kept her first name even though the sound of that one syllable made her jump every time, sure that someone from her past had caught up. But it was all she had left. Her mother was dead. Her father was dead. Sloane was dead. The only one who'd say her name with any sense of knowing was August. And he was hundreds of miles away in Verity, at the center of a city on fire.
Biatch. Makes a hell of a lot more sense than Corsai, Malkai, Sunai. Who named those?
Teo, much to handle.
No idea.
Biatch. Your lack of professional curiosity is maddening.
The Wardens had nagged Kate for months to meet up in person,
and when the time came, she'd almost bailed. She'd watched them from across the street, all looking so normal. Not that they blended in. Teo had short blue hair, and B had a full sleeve of tattoos, and Liam, in his giant orange glasses, looked like he was 12. But they didn't look like something spit out of Verity. They weren't Flynn Task Force soldiers, or coddled Colton kids. They were just normal. They had lives outside this one, things to lose. Liam and me.
Why not just call them what they are, what they do? Body eaters, blood eaters, and soul eaters. Bam.
Kate pictured August down in the subway, dark lashes fluttering as he raised his violin, the music pouring out where bow met strings, transfigured into threads of burning light. Calling him a soul eater was like calling the sun bright. Technically accurate, but only a fraction of the truth. Riled up.
Any sign of Kate?
She switched from incognito to public. Hunter K has joined the chat. Biatch.
Heyo!
Teo much to handle.
Stalker.
Riled up.
I was getting worried.
Liam on me.
Not me.
Biatch.
Yeah, right, Mr. I Know Karate.
Kate's fingers danced over the screen. Hunter K. No need, still standing. Riled up.
You really shouldn't go dark without properly signing off.
Teo much to handle.
Oh, Riley's in dad mode.
Dad mode. Kate thought of her own father, the cuffs of his suit stained with blood, the sea of monsters at his feet, the smug look on his face right before she put a bullet in his leg. But she knew what Teo meant. Riley wasn't like the rest of the wardens. He wouldn't even be there if it wasn't for her. He was a grad student studying law at the university and interning at the local police department, which was the part that mattered to the wardens, since it meant access to police surveillance and intel briefings. Not that Teo couldn't hack them, as he'd pointed out a dozen times, but why kick down an open door? According to Riley, the police were aware of the attacks and continuing to monitor developments, which, as far as Kate could tell, was just a long way of describing denial. Riled up.
Makes dad face, wags finger.
Riled up.
But seriously, you better not get any blood on my couch.
Hunter K. Don't worry. Hunter K. I left most of it on the stairs.
Liam on me.
Bug eyes. Hunter K. Any new leads? Teo much to handle.
Nothing yet. The streets are quiet.
What a strange idea. If she could keep this up, knocking out the heart eaters as they took shape instead of cleaning up the wreckage, two steps forward instead of back, maybe it wouldn't get worse. Maybe she could keep it from becoming a phenomenon. Maybe. What a useless word. Maybe was just a way of saying she didn't know. And Kate hated not knowing. She closed the browser, fingers hesitating over the darkened screen before she opened a new window and started searching for Verity. Kate had first learned how to tap into foreign signals at her second boarding school, out on the eastern fringe of Verity, an hour from the Temperance border. All 10 territories were supposed to transmit openly, but if you wanted to know what was really going on in another territory, you had to slip behind a digital curtain. That was the idea. But no matter how hard Kate looked, she couldn't find her way home. True, the quarantine had gone back into effect. The borders that had peeled open so slowly over the last decade slamming shut again. But there was no curtain to slip behind. Nothing coming out of Verity at all. The signal was gone. There was only one explanation. The tech towers must have gone down. With the borders closed and the comm grid out, Verity was officially cut off. And the people in Prosperity didn't care. Not even the wardens. Teo had used the word inevitable. B thought the borders should never have been opened,
That verity should have been left to consume itself like a fire in a glass jar. Even Riley seemed ambivalent. Only Liam showed the slightest concern, and it was more pity than a vested interest. They didn't know, of course, what verity meant to Kate. Hell. Kate didn't know either, but she couldn't stop searching. Every night she checked, just in case, clicked through every breadcrumb on the open drive, hoping for some news about Verity, about August Flynn. It was the weirdest thing. She'd seen August at his worst, watched him descend through hunger into sickness and madness and shadow. Watched him burn. Watched him kill. But when she pictured him now, she didn't see the Sunai made of smoke or the figure burning in a cold tub. She saw a sad-eyed boy sitting alone on the bleachers, a violin case at his feet. Kate shoved the tablet away and slumped back on the couch. She threw an arm over her eyes and let the steady beat of the radio fold around her until she sank down towards sleep. But then, in the lull between songs, the sound of footsteps echoed in the stairwell. She stilled, turning her good ear toward the door as the steps slowed, stopped. Kate waited for a knock, but it never came. Instead, she heard the sound of a hand on the doorknob, the shutter of the lock as it was tried but held fast. Kate's fingers slipped beneath the couch cushion and produced a gun. The same one she'd used to kill a stranger in her mother's house. The same one she'd used to shoot her father in his office. A muffled voice sounded beyond the door, followed by the scrape of metal, and Kate leveled the weapon at the door as it swung open. For a moment, the shape in the doorway was nothing but a shadow, the hall lights tracing the outline of a figure a fraction taller than she was, with round edges and short hair. No red eyes, no sharp teeth, no dark suit. Just Riley, standing there, juggling a box of pizza and a six-pack of soda and a key. He saw the gun and threw his hands up, dropping the cardboard and the cans and the key ring to the floor. One of the cans exploded, raining soda on the landing. "Damn it, Kate!" His voice was strangled. Kate sighed and set the weapon on the table. "You should knock." "This is my place," he said, retrieving the pizza box and the rest of the soda with shaking hands. "Do you pull the gun on everyone or just me?" "Everyone," said Kate. "But for you, I left the safety on." "I'm flattered." "What are you doing here?" "Oh, you know," he shot back, "checking on the squatter in my apartment, making sure she didn't trash the place." "You wanted to see if I bled on the couch." "And the stairs." His gaze flicked from her to the gun on the table and back. "Permission to enter?" Kate spread her arms along the back of the couch. "Password?" "I brought pizza." The smell emanating from the box was heavenly. Her stomach growled. "Oh, all right," she said. "Permission granted." Chapter 4. Rituals were funny things. People thought of them as either elaborate formulas, magic spells, or compulsions drilled into the subconscious by months or years of repetition. But really, ritual was just a fancy word for habit. A thing that became easier to do than not do. And habits were simple, especially bad ones, like letting people in. Kate curled up on one side of the couch, Riley on the other, while some late-night talk show host murmured bad jokes on the TV. He held up one of the cans he'd dropped.
"This will be fun,"
he said, cracking the tab. He cringed in expectation, then sighed with relief when it didn't explode. Kate grabbed a second slice of pizza, trying to hide the pain as the bandages tugged on the skin beneath her sleeve. "You didn't have to do this," she said between bites. He shrugged.
"I know."
She considered him over the crust of her pizza. Riley was slim, with warm brown eyes, the kind of smile that took over his face, and a savior complex. When he wasn't at the university or the police station, he volunteered with at-risk teens. Was that what she was to him? His latest project? Kate had been in Prosperity for all of 3 weeks when their paths crossed. She'd spent her nights squatting in abandoned buildings, her days nursing cups of coffee in cafe corners as she scoured the open drive for clues. It was only a matter of time before the cafe kicked her out. She hadn't bought anything in hours. Still, she didn't appreciate it when a guy sat down at her table on the pretense of studying, only to ask her if she needed help. She'd had her first run-in with a monster the night before, and it hadn't gone well. But considering that the extent of her experience, schoolroom self-defense aside, consisted of executing a bound Maokai in her father's basement and nearly getting disemboweled by a Corsai on the subway, she really shouldn't have been surprised. She'd gotten away with a split lip and a broken nose, but she knew she looked rough. She told the guy she wasn't interested in God or whatever he was selling, but he didn't leave. A few minutes later, a fresh cup of coffee appeared in front of her. "How did that happen?" he asked, nodding at her face. "Hunting monsters," she said. "Because sometimes the truth was strange enough to make people go away."
Okay,
he said, clearly skeptical. He got to his feet.
"Come on."
She didn't move.
"Where?" "I have a hot shower and extra bed. There might even be some food in the fridge."
"I don't know you." He held out his hand.
"Riley Winters."
Kate stared at his open palm. She wasn't big on charity, but she was tired and hungry and felt like shit. Besides, if he tried anything unwanted, she was pretty sure she could take him.
"Kate," she said.
"Kate Gallagher." Riley didn't try anything, thanks to the aforementioned boyfriend. Just gave her a towel and a pillow and a week later, a key. To this day, she wasn't exactly sure what had happened. Maybe she'd had a concussion. Maybe he was just persuasive. Kate yawned, tossing the paper plate onto the table beside her gun. Riley reached for the remote, switching the TV off. Kate responded by switching the radio on. Riley shook his head.
"What did silence ever do to you?"
He didn't know, of course, about the car wreck that had killed her mother and stripped the hearing from her left ear. Didn't know that when sound was taken from you, you had to find ways to take it back.
"If you want sound," said Riley, "we could always talk."
Kate sighed. This was his game. Ply her with food and sugar until she was blissed out on empty calories, and then invariably start prying. And the worst part was some masochistic part of her must want it, must relish the fact someone cared enough to ask, because she kept letting him in, kept ending up here on the couch with empty soda cans and pizza boxes. Bad habit. Ritual. "Okay," she said, and Riley brightened visibly. But if he thought she was going to talk about herself, he was wrong. "Why did you bring up that explosion?" Confusion streaked his face.
"What?"
"On the chat, you mentioned an explosion. Man-made. Why?"
"You saw that?"
He sat back.
"I don't know. The wardens have got me looking for things that don't line up, and it caught my eye. It's the 5th murder-suicide this week. That's really high, even for Prosperity."
Kate frowned.
"You think it's some kind of monster?"
Riley shrugged.
6 months ago, I didn't believe in monsters. Now I see them everywhere."
He shook his head. It's probably nothing.
Let's talk about something else.
How are you holding up?"
"Oh, look at the time," she said dryly. "Malcolm's going to get jealous."
"Thanks for your concern," he said, "but I assure you our relationship is stable enough to allow for time with friends."
"Friends?"
The word glanced off her ribs, hard enough to leave her winded. Because she knew a secret. There were two kinds of monsters. The kind that hunted the streets, and the kind that lived in your head. She could fight the first, but the second was more dangerous. It was always, always, always a step ahead. It didn't have teeth or claws, didn't feed on flesh or blood or hearts. It simply reminded you of what happened when you let people in. Behind her eyes, August Flynn stopped fighting because of her. He collapsed into darkness because of her. He sacrificed a part of himself, his humanity, his light, his soul, because of her. She could handle her own blood. She didn't need anyone else's on her hands. "Rule one," she said, forcing her voice even, light. "Don't make friends. It never ends well." Riley rolled a soda can between his palms. "But doesn't it get lonely?" Kate smiled. It was so easy when you could lie. "No." Chapter 5. Violence has a taste, a smell, but most of all, it has a heat. The shadow stands in the street, engulfed in smoke, in fire, in wrath, in rage, basking in the warmth. And for an instant, light glances off a face, finding cheekbones, a chin, the barest hint of lips, for an instant. But it is not enough. It is never enough. One human holds so little heat, and it is cold again, hungry again. Its edges blurring back into darkness the way edges always do. It wants more, searches the night, and finds a woman, a pistol, a bed, a couple, a kitchen, a cutting block, a man, a pink slip, an office. The whole city, a book of matches, just waiting to be struck. Chapter 6. Verity. The steel violin shone beneath his fingers. Its metal body caught the sun, turning the instrument to light as August ran his thumb along the strings, checking them one last time.
"Hey, Alpha, you ready?"
August shut the case and swung it up onto his shoulder.
"Yes."
His team stood waiting, huddled in a patch of sun on the north side of the seam, a three-story barricade that stretched like a dark horizon line between North and South City. Ani was drinking from a canteen, while Jackson studied the magazine on his gun, and Harris was, well, he was being Harris, chewing gum and throwing knives at a wooden crate on which he'd drawn a very crude, very rude picture of a Maokai. He'd even named it Sloan. It was a cool day, and they were dressed in full gear, but August wore only combat slacks and a black polo, his arms bare save for the rows of short black lines that circled his wrist like a cuff.
"Checkpoint one," said a voice over the comm. 5 minutes.
August cringed at the volume, even though he'd pulled the comm piece out of his ear and let it hang around his neck. The voice belonged to Philip, back at the compound.
"Hey, Phil," said Harris. "Tell me a joke." "It's not what the comms are for." "How about this one?" offered Harris. "A Korsai, a Maokai, and a Sunai walk into a bar."
Everyone groaned, including August. He didn't really understand most of the FTF's jokes, but he knew enough to recognize that Harris's were awful.
"I hate waiting," muttered Jackson, checking his watch. "Have I mentioned how much I hate waiting?"
"So much whining," radioed their sniper Rez from a nearby roof. "How's it looking up there?" asked Ani.
"Perimeter's clear, no trouble."
"Too bad,"
said Harris.
"Idiot,"
radioed Philip. August ignored them all, staring across the street at the target. The Porter Road Symphony Hall. The building itself was embedded in the seam, or rather, the seam had been built up around the building. August squinted at the soldiers patrolling the barricade and thought he spotted Sorrow's lean form before remembering that Sorrow would be at the second checkpoint by now, half a mile east. At his back, the usual argument was kicking off like clockwork.
Don't know why we bother. These people wouldn't do the same for... not the point. Isn't it, though? We do it, Jackson, because compassion must be louder than pride.
The voice came through the comm set, crisp and clear, and August instantly pictured the man it belonged to. Tall and slim with surgeon's hands and tired eyes. Henry Flynn, the head of the FTF. August's adopted father.
Yes, sir,
said Jackson, sounding suitably chastised. Ani stuck out her tongue, Jackson gave her the finger. Harris chuckled and began dislodging his knives. A watch chirped.
Showtime, said Harris brightly.
There had always been two kinds of people in the FTF. Those who fought because they believed in Flynn's cause, Ani, and those for whom Flynn's cause was a good excuse to fight, Harris. Of course, these days there was a third kind. Conscripts. Refugees who'd crossed the seam not because they necessarily wanted to fight, but because the alternative of staying in North City was worse. Jackson was one of those, a recruit who'd bartered service for safety and ended up as the squad's medic. He met August's gaze.
After you, Alpha.
The team had taken up their formal positions on either side, and August realized they were looking at him, looking to him, the way they must have looked to his older brother once, before Leo was killed. They didn't know, of course, that August had been the one to kill him. That he had reached into Leo's chest, wrapped his fingers around the dark fire of his brother's heart, and snuffed it out. Didn't know that sometimes when he closed his eyes, the cold heat still ached in his veins. Leo's voice echoing steady and hollow in his head. And he wondered if gone was gone, if energy was ever lost, if... August? It was Ani speaking now, her eyebrows arched, waiting. It's time. He dragged his spiraling mind back into order, allowed himself a single slow blink before he straightened and said in the voice of a leader,
"Fall in line."
They crossed the street with quick, sure steps, August at the front, Jackson and Ani flanking him on either side, and Harris at the rear. The FTF had stripped the plated copper from inside the hall and nailed it to the doors, creating solid sheets of burnished light. The presence of so much pure metal would burn a lesser monster. Even August cringed, the copper turning his stomach. But he didn't slow. The sun was already past its peak, the shadows beginning to lengthen along the street. An inscription had been etched into the copper plating on the northern doors. South City Checkpoint 1. By the will of the FTF, access will be granted to all humans from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., no weapons allowed beyond this point. Proceed to the Symphony Hall. Note, by entering this facility, you are consenting to be screened. August brought his palm to the door, and the other FTFs twisted out of the way as he pushed it open. Once, early on, he'd come face to face with an ambush, taken a round of heavy fire to the chest. The bullets had done nothing to August. A well-fed Sunai was impervious to harm. But a glancing shot had taken Harris in the arm, and ever since, the team was more than willing to let him serve as a shield. But as August stepped inside, he was greeted only by silence. According to a plaque on the wall, the Porter Road Symphony Hall had been a center of culture in the capital for more than 75 years. There was even an image beneath the writing, an etching of the main lobby in all its wood and stone and stained glass glory, filled with elegant couples in evening attire. As August moved through the room, he tried to bridge the gap between what it had once been and what it was now. The air was stale, the stained glass gone, the windows boarded up and covered over with more stripped copper, the polished stone floor littered with debris, and the warm light traded for ultraviolet reinforced bulbs burning high enough for him to hear, loud and clear as a comm signal. The lobby itself was empty, and for a single, hopeful, foolish second, August thought that no one had come, that he wouldn't have to do this. Not today. But then he heard the shuffle of feet, the muffled voices of those waiting in the symphony hall just as they'd been told. His fingers tightened on the violin strap. Ani and Jackson branched off to do a quick sweep, and he drifted forward, stopping before the depiction of a woman set into the floor. She was made of glass. Hundreds, maybe thousands of small glass squares, something more than the sum of its parts. A mosaic, that was the word.
Left all clear.
The figure's arms were stretched out and her head was thrown back as music spilled in gold squares from her lips.
Right hall, clear.
August knelt and ran his fingers over the tiles at the edge of the mosaic, tracing the purples and blues that form the night around her, letting his hand rest on a single golden note. She was a siren. He'd read about sirens, or rather, Ilsa had read about them. August had always been more interested in reality than myth. Reality, existence, that fickle state of being between a whimper and a bang. But his sister had a fondness for fairy tales and legends. She was the one who had told him about the women of the sea. Their voices beautiful and dangerous enough to send sailors crashing onto rocks. Sing you a song and steal your...
Ready when you are, said Ani at his side.
His fingers fell away from the cool glass tiles, and he straightened, turning toward the inner doors, the ones that led into the symphony hall itself. The violin hung heavy on his shoulder, every step creating a faint hum of strings only he could hear. August stopped before the doors and touched his comm.
Count.
Philip's voice buzzed across the line.
On camera, it looks like about 40.
August's heart sank. But this was why he was here. This, he reminded himself, was what he was for. Chapter 7. Once, the symphony hall might have been stunning, but time, the phenomenon, the territory wars, the creation of the seam, had clearly taken its toll. August's gaze trailed across the hall, the copperless ceiling, the walls scraped bare, the rows devoid of seats, before landing inevitably on the people huddled in the center of the floor. 43 men, women, and children who'd crossed the seam in search of shelter and safety, their eyes wide from too little sleep and too much terror. They looked bedraggled, their once fine clothes beginning to fray, bones showing beneath their skin. It was hard to believe these were the same people August had passed in the streets and on the subways of North City, people who could afford to pretend that the phenomenon had never happened, who'd scorned South City for so many years and purchased their safety instead of fighting for it, who'd closed their eyes and covered their ears and paid their tithes to Callum Harker. But Callum Harker was dead. August had reaped that soul himself. He hung back now, letting Harris take the lead. The soldier marched down the center aisle, leaped up onto the stage and spread his arms with the flair of a natural performer.
Hello, he said cheerfully.
And welcome to Checkpoint One. I'm Captain Harris Fordham, here on behalf of the Flynn Task Force.
August had heard Harris give this speech 100 times.
You came here of your own choice, so you've clearly got some sense. You also waited 6 months to make that choice, so you haven't got much.
He was right. These were the dregs, the ones convinced they could get by without South City's help. Too stubborn to admit or too foolish to realize what they were in for. In those first few weeks, when it was obvious that Callum's death rendered his promise of protection void, there had been a massive influx, hundreds of people streaming through the seam every day. Jackson and Rez had been among them. But some of them chose to stay, lock themselves in their homes, hunkered down and waited for help to come to them. And when it didn't, They were left with three options. Stay put, brave the waste, that dangerous place beyond the city where order gave way to anarchy and everyone was out for themselves. Or cross the seam and surrender.
You made it here, continued Harris. So you know how to follow directions. You're also a sorry-looking bunch, so I'm going to make this nice and simple.
Somewhere in the crowd, a man muttered,
Don't have to take this,
and turned to go. Jackson blocked his path.
You can't keep me here, snarled the man.
Actually, said Jackson,
you should have acquainted yourself with the fine print. Entering a screening facility serves as consent to be screened. You haven't been screened yet, so you're not free to go. Consider it a precaution.
Jackson gave the man a good, hard nudge toward the stage as Harris's face turned from cheerful to somber.
Listen to me. Your governor is dead. His monsters see you as food. We are offering you a fighting chance, but safety isn't free. You know that because you all chose to pay for it with cash. Well, bad news.
He shot a dark glance at a woman clutching a roll of paper bills in her ringed hands.
That's not how it works in South City. You want food? You want shelter? You want safety? You have to work for them.
He jabbed a finger at the FTF badge on his uniform.
Every day and every night we're out there fighting to take this city back. The FTF used to be optional. Now it's mandatory. And every citizen in South City serves.
Ani gestured for him to wrap it up, and just like that, Harris's demeanor flipped back to friendly.
Now, maybe you're here because you've seen the light. Maybe you're here because you're desperate. Whatever the reason, you've taken the first step, and for that we commend you. But before you can take the next, we've got to screen you.
That was August's cue. He pushed off the wall and began a long walk down the center aisle, his boots beating out a steady rhythm amplified by the hall's acoustics. Someone started to cry. The acoustics amplified that, too. He scanned the crowd, searching for the telltale twitch of a person's shadow that only Sunai could see, the movement that marked a sinner. But the light in the hall and the nervous shifting made it difficult to spot. Whispers moved through the room as he passed. Even if they hadn't yet realized what he was, they seemed to sense he wasn't one of them. He'd worked so hard for so long to blend in, but it didn't matter now. A little girl, maybe 3 or 4, he'd never been good at telling age, clutched at a woman in green. Her mother, he guessed, based on the steel in those tired eyes. August caught the little girl's gaze and offered what he hoped was a gentle smile, but the girl just buried her face in her mother's leg. She was afraid. They were all afraid. Of him. The urge to retreat rose like bile in his throat, competing with the urge to speak, to assure them that there was no reason to be afraid, that he wasn't there to hurt them. But monsters couldn't tell lies.
This is your place,
said a voice in his head, smooth and hard as stone. A voice that sounded like his dead brother, Leo.
This is your purpose.
August swallowed.
This part's simple, Harris was saying. Spread out, arms distance apart, there we go.
As August stepped onto the stage, the room went quiet. So quiet he could hear their held breaths, their frightened hearts. He knelt, opening the clasps on his case. The snap as loud as a gunshot in his ears, and withdrew his violin.
Sunai, Sunai, eyes like coal.
The sight of the instrument and the sudden understanding of what the FTF meant when they said screening sent a ripple of shock through the room.
Sing you a song and steal your soul.
A man in his mid-30s lost his nerve and took off at a full sprint toward the doors. He made it 3 or 4 strides before Ani and Jackson caught up and forced him to his knees.
Let me go,
begged the man.
Please, let me go.
Why? Chided Jackson.
Got something to hide?
Harris clapped his hands to draw the crowd's attention back to the stage.
The screening is about to begin.
August straightened and brought the violin to rest beneath his chin. He stared out at the audience.